I'm Alex Hirsch, the creator of the show.
Hey, I'm Michael Rienda. I was the inspiration for the love guy. Get ready. World, everyone's favorite character.
Woo-hoo. I'm Rob Brunzetti. I'm the supervising producer of the
show. So, Love God. Here it is. We're at Love God.
We're at Love God.
Love potions are a pretty awful TV trope. The concept of love potions suggests a like completely stupid one-dimensional idea of love. But
that we all bought into
but I here's sort of the genesis of this episode came from it came from the idea that Robbie was kind of introduced as a pretty important character in season one, and in season two we were planning out our entire sort of season arc, and at this point in the season, like, we knew the broad contours. We knew that the 10th episode, Ford is going to show up. We knew that the last episode is going to be the last episode of the series. And we were thinking about the entirety of the series, and we realized Robbie doesn't really have an end.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's no end to the Robbie story. And I was thinking about how Robbie is another one of these characters who's sort of designed just to be a jerk.
Yeah.
But I always had a fondness for Robbie because I saw him as so clearly vulnerable. Like, he wears his pain on his sleeve. Like, it's so obvious that he's just such a loser. And Dipper being intimidated by him is sort of just an accident of their age and their happenstance, because Robbie does not have a lot to offer the world. And characters like that can be quite endearing. And I thought, the point of this episode was I wanted to give Robbie sort of a happy ending. Like, I wanted to give him a situation where we saw him vulnerable, because it's a Robbie episode. It's something I always say: let's go to his house, let's meet his parents, let's get to know him better. And we were trying to think of a plot for this, and the broad contour was, oh great, Mabel's a matchmaker. Mabel's the one who tries to find Robbie somebody to get together with. But we were missing magic.
Yeah.
That was right. Part of the issue. It was like, the Gravity Falls is a series that plays on all these magic and mystery tropes. So we want to do a Robbie episode. Robbie and Mabel is going to be a really funny combination. She's so optimistic, he's so pessimistic. That's great. We need magic. How about love potions? And I don't remember exactly how this came about, but we said, what if the love potions came from Cupid, and what if Cupid was Mike Rienda? yes. Mike, were you part of those conversations?
Yeah, I was. Actually, I don't know if you remember, but it was like, this is before season two came out. I remember you and I were like, oh, we need to come up with a big season arc, and you know what? Let's go back to Mecca. We went to CalArts.
Like,
to brainstorm ideas.
That was a lot of fun, actually.
We were just like roaming the halls of our old school. Like, what if there was one of these episodes? And this episode, I remember sort of I was part of the early conversations.
Yeah,
because the teen characters were based on my friends from high school.
That's
like
right.
Nate Baranco, Lee Morrow, there's Nate and Lee themselves.
Nate and Lee are friends of Mike's, like, inspired by real people.
And we remember, like, because it was interesting, because we always made jokes like, oh, nobody's going to remember the teens, ha, ha, ha. But people actually liked the teens, which we were surprised by. And we were like, oh, well, then let's give them another episode. And it tied into the desire to give, like, Robbie some sort of, like, respect and not just make him a flat character.
Yeah. We had some of those pieces of, like, we want to do another teen episode, we want to do a Robbie episode.
Yeah.
Right.
And then it was initially going to be kind of like this, like, Cupid as John C. Reilly, like, hey guys, this is me, this is Cupid. And then it slowly dissolved into me as Cupid, because
well,
I mean,
that's
sort
not,
of a...
You act like those two things are very far apart.
There is
they are not
big Venn diagram.
It was like I'm a slurry, loud slob.
Yeah. We have our own slurry slob.
And Josh Weinstein, who wrote this episode, he always loved the teens. His favorite episode was Inconveniencing, and he came on the show. He's like, if you got a teens episode, I want to write it. So we brought him on. And he wrote this draft, and a lot of these great jokes, particularly in this first act, come from him. And then there's this idea, we need a personality for Cupid. We're trying to think of a Gravity Falls version of him. So how about he's kind of this kind of lame has-been rocker, but he's just got over the top confidence, because I don't know if you guys could tell from this commentary, but our buddy Mike has dangerous levels of confidence.
Well, and
he's the best guy to go to Vegas with.
Hey,
putting a rainbow wig on a big white gorilla.
Mike did not end up being the voice of the love guy.
No. It was John DiMaggio.
We ended up getting John DiMaggio, who is Manly Dan and Bender on Futurama and can do anything. And he was very much able to capture the vibe that we were going for.
Yeah, yeah.
Because Mike could not be Mike for this.
It's hard to be yourself, though. Yeah, it is hard totally. To be a cartoon version of yourself.
They're slow. I could probably take a few down. Wait, Mr. Pies! I've been thinking. Every year this festival comes by, and every year you shun what could be potential customers. You really think I can make money off of these freeloading, kale-munching freak shows? You just gotta figure out what appeals to them. How do I appeal to young people? So young people are into hot air balloons, eh?
Stan's, what are kids like? Hot air balloons, eh?
Very well observed.
That's a Josh Weinstein joke, which just made me laugh so hard because it's just so dumb. It's so, like, this week.
I think that was, like, one of the funniest moments in the entire show because I watched all these kind of fresh, and the idea of the giant Stan blimp on fire.
We'll get to that. Yeah.
That's one of the biggest laughs things I've ever had watching the show.
Here's Robbie's parents.
These two characters, Robbie's parents, I actually had these characters in mind like from the series Bible. Like they weren't in it, but when I was first coming up with the show, I always knew in my gut, like, Robbie's got really nice parents.
Yeah.
Like all of this pain and agony, it's just puberty. He doesn't really have a problem.
Yep.
He's playing it up. Kimberly Mooney is the voice of Robbie's mom. She was one of our development executives, sweet, lovable, and seemed perfect for this role. And I got to give also Josh credit for a lot of these just morbid gags.
And Kimberly Mooney actually started out as a production person on my show, Teenage
Robot.
Oh,
no kidding.
Yeah. Great, great, great.
Great exec. Get for her. Yeah. I love this scene. This was mostly written by Josh. Mabel's so sweet. I don't hear a no. Just get away. Get out of here. Huh? You want it. I'm going to help you. Great design on Robbie's room by our art team. If you look closely there, there's an anime drawing Robbie has done of him and Wendy, which is like, it's amazing. So sad and pathetic. There's poetry written on the walls. It's all lit in black light. It's just, it's a combination of you just take Hot Topic and put it in a blender from the 90s and barf it out. And Robbie is all of those tropes. But we see he really did like Wendy. She was definitely out of his league and was just sort of like, yeah, I guess I'll try out this guy.
Didn't you have kind of a backstory that Robbie had kind of liked Wendy for a really long time and kind of had built this persona in pursuit of her?
Yeah, I mean, I imagine Robbie sort of being this kind of very kindred spirit of Dipper, actually, that like they're both just hopelessly have this massive crush on this girl, and one of them is like older and in the right minute.
Yeah, one of them's just the right age.
But I sort of imagine that Robbie and Wendy probably met when they were younger. Like he immediately fell in love with her, has been pining after all this time, and then like when he started going through his goth phase and faking confidence, she was just like, oh, he's fun now. All right, yeah, I guess I'll date you. And then like, oh, you're kind of lame and you're lying about all this stuff. That's not cool. Peace out. Mabel, this is kind of us having fun with the fans a little bit. The idea of Mabel as the ultimate shipper of the Gravity Falls universe, that she sees everything through the lens of potential relationships. Because, like, I'll just brief sidebar here. Like, there is a massive zeitgeist that has grown from around the year of like 2011 till now that didn't exist prior, which was this idea that like, there is a massive contingency of people who watch every show and even cartoon shows solely through the lens of characters are going to have a romantic end goal, right? And I think a lot of people think that us writers in the room are like, who's going to get together? What are we going to tease? What does it mean? And we literally never think about it.
Right.
We never spend a minute being like, oh, but I always kind of hoped that this character, that it's meaningless to us. Like, all we think about is like, is this a compelling story?
Yeah.
Right. Do we like this character? If we like them, did they deserve a happy ending? And will this create conflict? And will this create entertainment? And this idea that like we are like, who's gonna love who? Like it doesn't exist. But there's so much people being like, oh, you always wanted it to be these characters. You were trying to do, and it's like we just don't care.
Well, because love is kind of not the end of a story, right?
Yeah,
it's part,
at all.
That's a character relationship. Like Dipper and Mabel love each other, but that's not a story. You
know
what I mean? They love each other's sister and brother. Okay, well, what comes out of that? What comes out of that love? Or how do they conflict even though they love each other? Like the idea that love is the end. Like, anybody that's fallen in love in real life knows that isn't the end. You don't, you know, your life doesn't fade off.
It's just
fade
a,
out.
It's just a story turn.
It's
right?
A, it's,
just
a turn.
It's just a turn into the next story. Here he is.
Here he is.
Love this, God. His outfit inspired by a real shirt Mike wears.
I was once at the Disney studio wearing this shirt in front of this scene, and it was the exact same shirt. Also, these boards were like, these are Sabrina boards, right?
Yeah, Sabrina Coutinho did these.
Crushed it.
Did an unbelievable job. A lot of the lines that Love God says in this, like, you know, who, like, these are Mike-isms. Like, we're going to make miracles happen. Yes. It's going to be the most epic night of your life, baby.
Yeah.
Hey, get it, girl. You know what you love.
Yeah, that's a catchphrase.
That's an actual, I think every year Mike has a new catchphrase. And he's like 2014 or whatever it was. Yeah. He's like, get it, girl. You know what you love. That's
your,
the phrase of this
your
year.
Catchphrase for
yeah,
this
what's
year,
this
Mike?
Year's
my
catchphrase?
My catchphrase right now is, hey, we're all having a good time doing audio commentary.
I feel like you kind of lost the magic on your catchphrase.
I think I did.
Needs work. Needs work.
I gotta, get it, girl. You know what you love.
I got to give Robert Ryan Corey, our character designer, credit for a lot of the designs of this diner. And Love God's crazy tattoos. I think he came up with some of those. Or was it Stephanie come up with the tattoos? You know, I think Corey
did. I do
did,
not remember.
I think Stephanie did the tattoos, and I think Corey did the people in the diner. This gag about the snagger, that's Josh Weinstein.
Yeah.
Like, prove it. Prove that you've got love potion.
Josh Weinstein is like, he was like one of our heroes, and it was like so mind-blowing that he was like working on this cartoon show, and when you met him, he was everything you wanted him to be. He's like the sweetest guy, and will answer all of your 700 Simpsons questions. Like, and just like with just a smile on his face.
So yeah, for context, Josh Weinstein was a classic Simpsons writer who
and showrunner too.
And showrunner, him and Bill Oakley, his writing partner, showran. They wrote like seasons like 4 through 7, and they showran I think season 6 and 7. And like when I was Dipper's age, when I was 12 years old, and they're like the internet barely worked, and I was taping things on VHSs. I knew Josh Weinstein's name, because I made charts. I was such a nerd. I had the Simpsons book, and I circled the names of writers on episodes that I loved, and I tried to come up with a pattern, like, when are episodes funnier? And I was like, when it's a John Vitti episode, it's really funny. When it's a Schwarzwelder episode, and when it's Josh and Bill, like, these are some of the best episodes.
Yeah, totally.
And when I heard after season one that Josh Weinstein of Simpsons fame, my childhood hero, like, was interested in writing the show, I couldn't believe it.
Yeah.
And I remember coming out into the lobby, people said, Josh Weinstein is here, and there was this kind of, like, slick-looking businessman, like, hanging out like with a cup of coffee, and I was like, is that Josh? And I like walk up to him, and he leaves, and I see somebody else, you know, this kind of like gray hair, he kind of looks like a professor, and then I just see like this sweet, like, just like friendly looking nerdy guy sitting on the couch, like, eating candy, being like, oh, is there any way I could get a poster to take home to my kids? And I was like, is this a fan? And like, I couldn't believe that Josh was just so soft-spoken and nice and kind and helpful, and he just loved the show. And was willing to give it his all to be on it. And this was his first episode, and we said, you know, go nuts, have fun. Like, it was weird because he'd write these jokes where you'd be like, oh, that feels a little bit familiar, like a Simpsons joke. And you'd be like, wait a minute, that's because he wrote the Simpsons joke. Like, you're always trying to, like, catch yourself in the writer's room, like, don't be too much like the Simpsons. But, like, it's literally Josh.
Yeah.
The Simpsons writer.
And he just, like, those, like, fall out of his sleeves, like, these amazing punchlines.
That line, I'll give you the Mabel guarantee, what was it like? I give you happiness or twice your sadness back. Like, lines like that, like, could only come from a guy like Josh. This whole sequence here, this is, I know that there's some people who've watched this episode and felt like, oh, you know, we don't like it that the characters turn against each other, and the idea that, you know, these, you know, Wendy and Tambry would be at each other's throats like this, it makes them feel a little one-dimensional. But, like, I can speak to personal experience that, like, friend groups are a delicate balance.
Yeah.
Like, I have so many social situations where there's this one linchpin friend who, if they're there, you got like 8 people from 8 different groups. And if they're not there, the entire group just dissolves.
Yeah.
Like, I had a guy at CalArts, Dimitri, who, like, was just this lovable dude, who, when he was around, multiple different groups. Mike is one of those guys. When Mike's around, combines a bunch of different friend groups.
That's right, kids. I have friends.
And, like, we definitely saw this teen group as having a very specific specific dynamic where Wendy's the cool one, Tambry's her kind of like aloofly unapproachable friend, Robbie's the guy who fakes confidence and everybody kind of goes along with it because he, like, you know, he brings the fun. Yeah. Like, Nate and Lee are just like these chill dudes who just like to mess with each other. Yeah. And Thompson really is the glue, actually. Yeah. Like, Thompson's based on a real friend of Mike's.
Yeah.
Was his name actually Thompson?
Yeah, no, it wasn't. His name is not Thompson. His name will not be mentioned. He's a great innocent guy.
But there's like real friends that these guys are based on. And it's like, it's just like a real social option. So the idea that one crush could completely obliterate a friend group, very much borne out in reality,
totally,
in my experience. And it felt like good stakes. Like, here are the social stakes. Like, this is the lesson Mabel needs to learn this episode, is like, you start messing with love, you start poking around in this business, there's going to be massive consequences.
And social stakes, we always found, were like way more compelling than like physical stakes. Like, seeing this friend group break up apart, if you're invested in it, you care more about than if somebody's going to live or die, because you're like, this is a kid show. They're not going to die. They're not really going to die.
Yeah.
I mean, physical states are great, but without an emotional story to follow, they don't really land.
This joke, ugh, they're doing that gross hug walk. That's something that I always see at the county fair, is you've got teen couples, like, they're so proud to be in a couple for the first time that they're, like, being as PDA as they possibly can be.
Hands in each other's pockets.
This scene where Love God stumbles out of a van with groupies mussing his hair.
Much like my own life, I have a lot of groupies, guys.
That's not real.
That's
Mike does not have groupies.
I have a wife,
but maybe after this commentary, you will.
Yeah, baby.
Anti-love. To reverse the effects of love potion, simply spray on your...
Kristen had a problem with this line, love of country music. Ew. I think that might have been a Jeff Rowe line. I just know that, like, it always made me laugh, and Kristen was like, Mabel would love country music. It's so soulful. But it cracked me up to have her randomly hate something.
Yeah.
It's just so unexpected. John did a great job in the booth as this character. Made him likable, even though he's clearly in the third act of his life.
Clearly a monster.
Emmy Cicierega storyboarded on this episode, and I think the Handlebar Bros, I think that was one of her gags. I think she might have drawn one of the gags, but I'm pretty sure that this entire fight sequence was done by Sabrina. Like,
that sounds right.
Some of this
but
stuff.
But it feels like it.
Well, this is a Sunil gag. There's so many people who work on this where it's like you recognize bits and pieces of their work. This chase scene features one of the hardest to find hidden messages in the entire series. This season we had Visionaire code word, where there'd be a code word next to a key, and that's how you would decipher the code at the end of the credits. And we would hide a keyword in every episode, and this pan is where the word is hidden, I think.
Yeah, that sounds right. And Ian, the art director, just got more and more vindictive.
Yeah, well, our art director was getting frustrated that people were so... people found them so easily, so we started getting harder and harder. Yeah. And this is the hardest one he ever did. And even I couldn't... I remember he showed me the background for approval, and I couldn't find the hidden message. And I was looking right at it. But fans found it within, minutes of this airing.
Yeah, he can never outrace the fans.
Mabel having a crush on Alexander Hamilton from the back of the $10 bill was a joke that was in the pilot.
Yep.
And that was based on a friend of mine who had a sister who always said she always thought that guy was dreamy, and I thought it was so
that's
weird.
I can't believe that that's actually
true.
Well,
this was before Hamilton the musical.
That's amazing.
That was Bridget Berger's sister. Okay, now this joke is the best part of the entire episode.
Yeah, it was all built around this.
And this all comes from Brian Dole.
Oh, really?
Yeah, this was... We were in the writer's room, and we were thinking about this idea that, like, there's some gag with a balloon, and Brian Dole, who's our line producer, like, they set the schedule, like, they are the boss. But they're not normally, like, in the creative, but he was just sitting there with his notepad, and he's like, what if it says, I heart kids, and you cross it out, and it's, I eat kids. And it was, like, it was such a perfect idea.
And then it led
to this moment. It led to, like, oh my God, like, that's so funny. What if it's so horrifying? And everybody brought it. Like, the designers, the music.
There was a lot of love put into that.
Well, in an episode like this, it's very, like, silly and low stakes. Like, oftentimes they're not our most beloved episodes because they aren't game changers. But sometimes they contain the best jokes in the series because they're just us having fun. I also really love this joke. Oh, I hope no one died in there. Yes, that would be awful. Like, they are so excited about the idea of having new bodies to embalm. It's so messed up. That's a Jeff Rowe joke that, in my day, Zeppelins were falling out of the air like raindrops. Like, how old does he think Stan is? I would ride a penny any farther well, to Jeff, the castle. I'm like, what?
Jeff is young enough, or at least he was when the show was going on, that like anything that's more than 5 years old is just loop, just all gathered into the same oldsy timesy, olden days time period.
Rob, you sound a little touchy about.
Oh, I am so touchy
about young writers making jokes about old things.
You can't see it at home, but Rob just punched a hole through a window. He's furious.
Well, and I will mention that like Rob is one of these guys who's like he's worked on all these great shows, and sometimes when you work with somebody who's got a lot of experience, you worry that they're going to be stuck in their ways, that there's going to be some kind of generation divide, and like it was. Rob got along and like immediately fit in with our group. Like, yeah. Like we're just a bunch of CalArts knuckleheads. Here's a guy who's just like made all these incredible cartoons and knows how the right way to do it. And it was an immediate love connection. Like, yeah. It was immediately like, you just want to make something really fun and great and you're willing to push it. And you're like, a lot of people like get really frustrated working with like straight out of college kids. Like I know a lot of people in the industry who are just like, oh, these kids back in, we did it differently on Two Stupid Dogs.
Yeah,
like, what, I mean,
I experienced when I was the young kid, I experienced those people
yeah.
And I vowed to never be one of them. I am.
I mean, you kept your promise.
Yeah. I'm excited.
You're the best.
I'm excited to work with people that want to do fun, good stuff. Regardless of their age and
level thank you for maturity. Not being ageist to us.
And I mean I think I didn't necessarily get all the 20-year-old references that only made sense to you guys, but I don't think that was necessary to be a part of this group because again any show that's worth its salt is based on characters and based on real things that make the fun fantasy things more fun. And this show has that in spades. The fact that all these teens are based on actual people makes them real. And it's just a pleasure to work on something where it's not just gags a minute for the sake of cartoon gags that have been done generation after generation, but there's a point to it and there's
Well, and you provided just a lot of insight about like, you'd look at a story and say, that's not gonna work. And it was like you had that experience that we didn't have yet. Like, and I like gained over the course of the series. Like now I can look at an outline and be like, that's busted. But like, I learned so much of that from you. Huge shout out to Neil Cicerigo who did this song.
Oh yeah.
Emmy, his sister, boarded this. He wrote the song. They sent it to me on my phone and I was like crying laughing because it was so good. Like little surprises like that are the best part of working in a team because people will bring their own creativity to it. And sometimes they just knock you out.